This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
I've listened to this joke probably 30 or 40 times.
Wow.
I've had questions about it. Whenever I do public speaking, I'm so nervous beforehand that listening to you, and I have a few go-tos, it's like an injection that makes me a better public speaker for about 45 minutes.
Wow.
In my entire life, I've been abbreviating the states. I've never thought, oh, so many states have the same first two letters. Like, what were you doing when you thought of that?
I think from the first time when I was in second grade and I got the arrow book of the states. I got it in second grade, but it had to have been printed several years prior because the idea of the two capital letter abbreviations was a new concept in this particular version of the arrow book of states that I got from the RIF van, the Reading is Fundamental van that came to my school. And I remember for whatever reason, I wanted to memorize the abbreviations and I noticed how difficult it was.
So you pulled that out. And, you know, 40 years later.
Yeah, 30 years later.
This could be a joke.
Yeah.
You turned that kind of difficulty you had in second grade into a joke. Introducing brooklinen.com, high quality sheets and bedding at a price that won't keep you up at night. It's the fastest growing bedding brand in the world because people love these products. Their sheets have over 12,000 five-star reviews. I love my Brooklinen sheets. Try these sheets and I know you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code James at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. There's really no reason not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code James at brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code James. Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever. Gary Goldman, world famous, great comedian. Thanks once again for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be back. I'm very honored and flattered that you have me back a second time.
Well, I want to tell you that you've been incredibly helpful to me this past year because every time I give a talk, and I occasionally give talks for whatever reason, I always listen to one of your comedy clips right beforehand.
Oh, really?
And I do that mirror neuron thing. So then I go on the stage and I have a little bit of hopefully your brain inside of my brain a little bit. So
wow.
I become a better public speaker as a result.
Wow. That makes me feel really good. That's really nice of you to say.
Yeah. I would say you and Louis C.K. are like my go-to clips.
God.
Before
wow.
I do public speaking. And I highly encourage anybody to listen to comedy before public speaking, because I feel like I get scared enough when I'm public speaking. And then I've also tried recently to do something incredibly hard, which you have been doing for 25 years, which is for the past just month or so, I've been trying to do stand-up comedy, and it's 10 times harder and scarier than public speaking.
Oh,
so
it's
I
hard,
have
yeah.
huge respect. And I think learning that skill or even attempting to learn that skill has helped me in a variety of ways. But that's why I wanted you back on, because I wanted to take one of your jokes,
okay,
which has fascinated me, and break it down word for word.
All right.
So first off, how are things going in general? You're on a year ago. How are you feeling?
Very anxious.
Why?
I just have a lot of anxiety in me as of late. I'm moving at the end of June. And I'm nervous about that, and I'm nervous about my future, because I haven't been able to come up with a new hour to tour with for the fall or anything. So I'm holding off on booking dates. So I'm very anxious these days.
Okay, let me ask you a couple questions. First, I'll start with the last. So let's say you do book a tour for the fall.
Yeah,
could maybe booking the tour push you? Are you the type of person where it'll push you, like force you to come up with that hour before the day of the tour? Like the night before, like it'll be a college exam, like the night before the tour, you'll be like coming up with some, you know, 16-minute joke about McDonald's or whatever.
Yeah, there was a time when I could create and turn over material much quicker than I'm doing now, and there's something going on with my brain or my confidence or something that I'm just not putting out as much new material as I used to. The time between my second special and my third special to get the material is a much shorter amount of time than I'm dealing with since my last special, which is now 2 years ago. I still don't have a new hour that I would feel comfortable making into a special. So
do you have like part of an hour? Like I've seen you do sets since then.
Yeah.
You have new material.
Yeah. Yeah, I have part of an hour, but it wouldn't be as good as the last special.
When you say as good, what's the metric you define? Because like for instance, when I saw you perform last, everybody was laughing at every joke.
Yeah.
So what's your bar? Like are you looking at it in terms of like your sense of quality or the audience's laughter, or what are you looking at? How do you judge yourself?
I don't know. I just know there's a certain reaction to certain jokes, like the fact that you want to go over word for word one of my jokes from my last special. I don't feel like there's anything on that I could put on a new special that would be that compelling and resonate with people to that extent. So it's disappointing, and I don't think I'm being overly critical. I just don't think I've written anything as good as that bit.
Well, people will hear the bit in a second because we'll go over it. But what if you don't have to do It seems like each year that I've watched, you know, so I go back before these, you know, podcasts, and I'll watch you perform in 2005, 2006, 2007, and it seems like there's obviously there's obviously an evolution in your style, and it's a very unique and I would say risky style, and I'll describe why in a second, and we spoke about it a little bit before the podcast started, but maybe you go, could you potentially go in a different direction where they don't have to take as huge, like the way they're risky is the time of a joke that you allow yourself, which is very unusual for like it's the opposite of a one-liner joke.
Right.
Maybe you can not to go in that direction and just be, you know, funny. You're obviously funny in a lot of different directions.
Yeah, I could try that. It's just not that particular avenue is not any that isn't any clearer than the old method. So I don't find that avenue anymore. Easy or ready.
Do you like, let's say you sit down for a session of writing. I don't know if you do that like every day. Do you like get your coffee and
there was a time when I did that, but I've stopped doing that. It's become too frustrating.
And so you get like angry at yourself.
Yeah, I get
and then
very
the people around you.
And I get very critical.
Like, does your girlfriend know to just sort of back off? And
no, there's never that. I never take it out on her or actually even let her know that I'm frustrated or struggling with the writing.
She should do a podcast with you then.
I know. That would be interesting.
When you say you're moving, where are you moving?
I'm going back to Boston.
You go back to Boston?
Yeah.
You're not gonna be in New York anymore?
Not for the next year, I don't think.
Why is that?
I just feel I need a change of scenery. Perhaps to jumpstart me and reignite me.
Now, have you also thought about other avenues other than stand-up? So you've really been like a stand-up's stand-up. Like that's been your main focus.
Yeah.
Have you thought about kind of the TV show route, the talk show route, any of these other routes that many comedians do?
Yeah, I've auditioned for a lot of roles over the years, and I've studied acting in classes with teachers and trainers and things, but I just haven't gotten that break that good fortune of getting cast on something, and I don't really have any ideas for shows that I'd want to pitch. I went that route early on in my career where I pitched several pilots and sold them to networks and had deals to make pilots and those didn't come to fruition. So I've been frustrated in that angle, and I just decided long ago to really concentrate on my stand up and really make that the focal point of my actions, and so I always take the auditions and I prepare for them when they come around, but I haven't booked anything in a long time.
It seems like, I mean, there's so many shows now out there that are like about struggling comedians coming up, like, and it kind of, I guess you could say it sort of started with Seinfeld, but then more recently there's Louis, the Jim Gaffigan show, crashing with
right.
Pete Holmes.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's still a direction to explore in pilot world.
Yeah.
I don't know. And like you have even a different take on it, which is like, let's say totally frustrated comedian trying to come out of that somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that might be something to think about in the future. Yeah. That's interesting.
So even though I know it might be painful for you to go over this joke,
it's not painful.
I want to ask a lot of questions about this one joke, and then maybe we can continue the line about what it takes to come up with another joke like this.
Yeah.
But so just to set the context, this is a joke from about a year ago, I guess, where you call it, or you basically go on Conan, and I'm sure there was other places you did it, but this transcript that I'm, so we both have a transcript in our hands. I have my notes on mine. Yours is poorly formatted because I'm sure you know all the joke, and it's a computer-driven transcript, so there's words misspelled. But this is a clip where you come out on stage and you're totally serious, and you basically start off saying, you know, everybody's clapping, and you start off saying, "Thanks very much. I just wanted to recommend a documentary to everyone, and then I'm going to go."
Yeah.
And that right there is boring and funny.
Yeah.
So like, nobody has turned on Conan to see the stand-up guy say, "Okay, I'm going to recommend a documentary, and then I'm going to go." And your voice is totally serious.
Yeah.
So there's like all these aspects, like you're committing to the joke, like you're totally serious. You're wearing almost a professorial outfit.
Right.
And it starts off boring. Like, "I'm going to recommend a documentary." Most people don't like documentaries. And then you say you're going to go.
Right.
So how did you start it off that way? Like, why?
I just think that's, I'm bragging, really, because I know that I have something in my pocket that I've worked on for so long and I've polished so frequently and so hard over the years. I mean, years and years I've gone into this one joke. And I know that they haven't seen it before on the show tonight, and they haven't seen it before in their lives. So I know that I have something really, really special in my pocket for them. And there's something I think that comes across. I think that comes across that I'm bragging, that I'm overconfident about myself in this instant. When I'm telling them, it's almost like I'm saying, when do you get a load of me?
Right. Because it seems like a lot of comedians go out there and they want to kind of almost pander for a laugh as the very first thing to kind of build that rapport with the audience. You're doing it in a totally different way with this confidence. Like, you're committing so much into the joke that the audience is like, they know you're not just going to recommend a documentary, and they have to go along with this commitment. And that's part of what's funny here is that clearly you're not going to go. And so it's interesting. Okay. So then the next line is, and you're almost like a little, your style also is like, you're serious, but you're serious, but like a little nervous. Like, you repeat things. Like, you say, it's about the men and women who abbreviated all 50 states down to two letters. So first off, there is no documentary about the men and women who have, like, I looked at it, I've Googled it.
Yeah.
There are articles about how there's no documentary about it after you've done that bit. So how did you even think of like coming up with this fake documentary about the people who, you know, abbreviated all 50 states down to two letters? Like, where did that come from when you were first starting the joke?
Yeah, I mean, I had the joke for years and really no way to get into it until they started making documentaries about obscure subjects. And
so like a Helvetica you saw.
Exactly.
And you figured, oh, if they can make a documentary about font, did you start listing like what other stupid things can they make documentaries about?
No, I just wrote a joke about the Helvetica documentary. And then I thought, you know, what might work is to say that story that I tell about the states getting their abbreviations was a documentary. That's where you can find out about how the states got their abbreviations. Because I would tell it as a story, and it came out of nothing. There was no real setup to it. I would just have to just out of nowhere start talking about the states getting their abbreviations. And by saying that there was a documentary about it, then I could just tell the story of the documentary. So it took the evolution of documentaries and the making, I guess, film cheaper so that they could make obscure documentaries to enable me to write this joke.
And so it's that intersection where you kind of had previously a funny story about something obscure, like how did they come up with two-letter abbreviations for every state?
Yeah.
With and you intersected that with almost the stupidity, not stupidity, but like the ease by which we can make a documentary now and make these obscure, nonsensical documentaries. That intersection is what makes
exactly
really brings out the brilliance in this bit.
Yeah, well, it allowed me to do the bit, to have a setup for it, and to have a vehicle for it.
But now it's at this point where so early on in it that I think you veer off from basically 99.99% of comedians, because you're about to embark on a 6.5 minute joke where and it's about a topic incredibly boring, the abbreviation of states. And yet, I mean, I've listened to a couple different clips of it. It's you get laughs literally every line on it, but it's a huge commitment. Like, if at any point the audience is not with you or you start to falter, like, you're taking a huge risk.
Yeah, but I've gotten so much excellent feedback and encouragement from people like yourself and other comedians and just audience members that on the nights when it doesn't go very well, I still have that in my mind. I still have the confidence in it. So I know that it's just this particular audience that isn't enjoying it. And as soon as I'm done with the bit, I can go back to things that are a little less obscure for them and try to win them back. But I have confidence and believe in the bit enough that on the nights when the audience is not really with me, I can muddle through.
So let's say you're doing this in the middle of an hour. Do you try to build up, let's call it, capital with the audience before you start this one, just in case there's that risk?
Yeah, unless it's an audience that's all there to see me, that is made up of fans, and then I usually close with this joke or do it as a request at the end.
Okay, and then of course when you have a 6 minute spot on Conan, this is the joke you pick.
Yeah, that was my favorite one. Yeah.
So then the next thing is you set up the premise. All you need to know is we have 50 states in America and they each have two capital letter abbreviations, but that wasn't always the case up until, I want to say, 1973, so I will.
Right.
So that's funny. Like you kind of have these like little jokes inside, like I want to say 1973, and then you say, you didn't have to say so I will.
Right.
Like where's the, that was funny, everyone laughed. Again, I always try to figure out what's funny about that because I laugh too, but I'm trying to figure out what I'm laughing at.
Because it's a common cliche to say, I want to say 1973. And then people just say, they just go on with the sentence. And then, so I thought, let me try to say, and so I will. And so I will say 1973, because it's a cliche to say I want to say, and then you don't really finish that sentence. It's just a cliche.
I always wonder, like, how did you? And I know this is a hard thing to answer, and maybe I'm kind of getting too much into the weeds, but maybe other people constructing this joke in an alternative universe would just say it happened in 1973 instead of kind of, but then I guess it's not funny. Like, you're still trying to make each sentence funny. So yeah. You had from in your repertoire, you had the kind of like, let's break down this cliche and throw it in there.
Yeah. I mean, when I first started being interested in becoming a stand-up comedian, I saw a documentary and they interviewed Richard Jenny, the late Richard Jenny, who was great, and he put it so succinctly. He said, basically what you're trying to do is put together as many laugh lines as close together as possible. And if you watch his act, it was very tight, and it was very compact as far as how long you had to wait between laughs. So I took that. I thought that was very good. I thought that was very good advice and a very good observation. And not every comedian does that, and that's not the end all and be all. But for me, and also with my psyche, I enjoy hearing the laughs. It keeps me confident and able to continue on with the show if I'm getting laughs. Otherwise, I tend to get panicky.
So, because the line before where you set up the premise, there's not a laugh. You're just
There's no laugh there. It's just
but it's tight
pipe. What do you call it? Exposition.
Yeah, but you clearly can see you're taking out as many words as possible. Like, you're just trying to spit that part out.
Yeah,
and your movement during that has a little bit funny. Like, you're saying, like, yeah, you do this. Like, I shouldn't say you do this because we're on audio,
right.
But you're pointing to the sky, and you say, but it wasn't always that way. Like, you're still gesturing and acting it out, like almost like this professor.
Yeah, so, I need to keep their attention during that time because it's a lull.
Yeah, because you know even though it's like the comedian has the mic and you're speaking to the audience, you still have to kind of act out, it feels like, every line. That's part of it.
Yeah, it helps, yeah.
So, okay, so then there's a little bit more premise. Up until 1973, every state had its own length of abbreviation, and it was chaos. So the chaos is funny.
Yeah,
people laughed at that.
Chaos is a K sound, so it's a funny word naturally, and also it's such an overstatement that it's funny.
Right, and you kind of get more and more, as we'll see, you get more and more into the overstatements until this is like this, like, you know, thriller story.
Yeah.
So, and you know, also there's an element of, like, what do you think of this theory? There's an element of subtraction of your personality. Like, so in the real you knows that this is a boring story and it wasn't chaos. You're kind of subtracting that knowledge from yourself so you can get more and more into the absurdist aspects of this.
Yeah. I mean, I wish this was my personality. I think I'd be a really, really interesting, hip, quirky, not hip, but quirky guy. I wish... My entire act was made up of similar jokes, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I subtract my actual knowledge and yeah.
Well, but I feel like in every one of your bits you do some subtraction. So, like, let's take, there's the one bit you have where you're talking about role play with your girlfriend, and first she's the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
Oh, right.
And you're the Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and you feel she's not pushing her agenda. No.
Right.
And, like,
right.
It's this absurdist role play, which, again, you're subtracting, and then you get into the whole professor student thing.
Yeah.
But you're subtracting this part of yourself that's like, where normally a normal human being would remind themselves this is all sexual foreplay,
right.
And you subtract that and get so into the,
yeah,
oh no, I'm a professor and she's like a bad student.
Yeah, yeah.
And that subtraction also.
Sure.
So it seems like with all of these, like, long bits, there's like this huge subtraction to get this absurdist quality.
Yeah. Yeah, and it
you have to kind of be subtract in different ways, though. That's why you can't always be one way or the other.
Right, but it also depends on the audience also having believing. I'll watch certain comedians and I'll say, oh, that never happened to them, and clearly none of these things ever happened to me. But there's something about the manner or the commitment to the bit where the audience believes these things happened, or I don't know, but you're absolutely right. I do subtract the more knowledgeable side of my personality.
We'll get to this in this bit, but at some point it's clear you're not you, but you've committed so much to the persona that you're playing here that we're all in it with you.
Yeah.
So we'll get to that in a second. Because I have questions all along the way, as you could probably tell. I hope this is not boring for you going over this.
No, this library is interesting.
So okay, then you say Massachusetts was, so this is more exposition. Massachusetts was Mass, Florida was FLA, and then this is funny. Utah was Utah. They just dropped the H.
Yeah.
First off, is that true? Was Utah UTA?
I don't know, but it may have been.
Okay, well, that was funny, though.
Yeah.
Because people laughed at the Utah was Utah. Yeah. They just dropped the H.
Yeah.
So you're still making it. You're still kind of trying to find where to squeeze out some laughs along the way of the exposition.
Right.
And then you say, and then this was great. Then the post office said, every state needs a 2-capital letter abbreviation. So they convened a crack squad of abbreviators. They assembled a ragtag outfit of rogues, misfits, and never-do-wells. How often do well? Ne'er.
Yeah, ne'er-do-wells.
Ne'er-do-wells. And so that was funny. Like, so two things there. The crack squad of abbreviators.
Right.
There's obviously no such thing.
CERN.
Yeah. We now I'm in like one of those Bruce Willis robberies where it's like, you know, he finds 10 people and they're going to break into some safe. You know, that's the setting you're putting us in, but
sure.
It's about abbreviating states.
Yeah.
So now I know it's not true.
Right.
And you're playing a role, but I'm in it. Like, and I want to hear what the story is.
Yeah.
I still think maybe this is an actual story.
Right.
But I know you're not you anymore.
Yeah.
But it's funny. Crack has the K sound.
Yeah. You get the K, convene a crack squad. You get the alliteration and with a K sound, which is great. And then the image of abbreviators. And then,
yeah. Like, what's an abbreviator? Is there such thing as
no,
a professional abbreviator?
No. And then there's, the cliche of a ragtag outfit of rogues, misfits, and ne'er-do-wells. That's a group that would infiltrate a bank or something or
right. So I love the fact
rescue people.
So I didn't think of a. I didn't when I looked at this. I didn't realize the alliteration. But you're right. The convened a crack squad of whatever. And then this is the second time you've kind of made fun of a cliche. Is that like a common approach you would take? Like, how can we sort of find the cliche in this and then play with it?
Yeah, I like to do that. That's an easy joke that you can find in your material is just because you don't want to use cliches in your act because it's so it's too easy. But if you do use a cliche, then to what they call hang a lantern on it, where you sort of say, oh, no, I acknowledge I'm using a cliche here, but at least I'm going to try to squeeze some funny out of it. And the expression ne'er-do-well has in my experience, hasn't been unpacked. So I thought it would be good I think it's such a great put down of somebody to call somebody a ne'er-do-well.
Yeah, and it's also a phrase you never hear. Like,
right.
you start to use this language that's like 40 years old.
Yeah.
So like ne'er-do-well is not a word ever used right now.
Yeah.
And yet you could see it like in some sort of 1970s description of a movie. You know.
Yeah, I think sometimes somebody a friend of mine, I think it was his I think it was this particular friend named Rick Harris, who is a comedian. He's now a teacher, I think, but he said one of the things that's really funny is reminding people of a word they forgot they knew.
Like, what's an example from another bit where you might have used a word that people have forgotten? If you could remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can remember right off the top of my head, but it'll come to me.
Because I think that is a funny trick. There's a couple like tools here. There's like a a tool chest here of skills that can be unpacked to use or reuse. Like this kind of looking at cliches. Like it seems like you're trying to describe what these abbreviators are. So you use a cliche to do it, but you lengthen the cliche or you exaggerate the cliche with the use of ne'er-do-well.
Yeah.
And then you underline that by like, you know, ever-do-well, ne'er.
Right.
Or whatever. So, and I think you used the word ne'er like 3 or 4 times in the actual joke. I forget.
Oh, I don't remember doing that, but that's possible.
In those two lines, two lines. Like, I don't know if this transcription is accurate.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think within those two lines, I say, do they ne'er-do-well? No, ne'er. Ne'er. Yeah. They ne'er-do-well.
They were charged with abbreviating all 50 states down to 2 letters. I read the description of the documentary and thought to myself, how are they going to make a 98-minute documentary about a task that couldn't have taken more than 6 minutes to complete? So people laughed at that.
Yeah.
And I'm not
sure why they laugh at that, but I know that, I mean, that was more of a bridge, and the fact that they laugh at that was just a good fortune.
And also the specificity, the 98 minutes. Okay.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Like, because normally when I think of a movie, I think, oh, is this 90 minutes or, you know, 120, right, like 2 hours?
Yeah.
I wouldn't think like exactly 98 minutes.
Yeah.
So there's something there too. And also, why 6 minutes to complete? Like, why not 10 or less than 10?
Six has a k sound in it, and it's one syllable, and it's the right length word for.
So you're consciously thinking of the K sound,
yeah,
and you're thinking of reducing the syllables,
and it's a short amount of time, and it's yeah,
and then you get the bigger laugh. So you get a laugh there, but then you say, "Boy, was I wrong," and you get the much bigger laugh right there.
Yeah,
and I think it's because again, you're subtracting from yourself. Like, there's this almost like childlike enthusiasm,
right,
about a documentary about abbreviating. You know, boy, was I wrong. Nobody says boy. Like, right. Boy, was I wrong. Like, it's again, it's like, aw, shucks, 1950s style language. So it's clearly not you anymore, but yeah, we're in it.
Right. Yeah.
And it's I mentioned here in my notes, it's this innocence that's funny.
Right.
And I don't know how consciously, again, you were trying to do that or play that persona.
I was trying to play that persona of somebody who is very enthusiastic about this documentary and very excited. Yeah.
Then you get the laugh, so you extend the laugh with, it was an adventure, which clearly wasn't.
Yeah.
Then you extend it again, ups and downs, in and outs. Friends became enemies. Enemies became friends. And again, not only did you get laughter here, you got clapping here.
Right.
Were you expecting the clapping?
No, because that's one area that it's a line that I just do for myself, because it normally does not get a laugh. People don't find the expression "friends became enemies." Enemies became friends. They don't find that funny. And I think it's so over the top, dramatic that I thought people would always find that funny, but I wind up doing it 99% of the time just for my own enjoyment.
Really? You're doing it in a club or whatever?
No.
That's funny. So again, on the Conan clip that I watched over and over, people were laughing and clapping.
Yeah.
Because I guess they're appreciating that you extended it's all related to this ragtag group, and you're extending that, making them more and more like this dramatic spy thriller.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the worst thriller where everyone's gonna turn, it's like a mafia thing where everyone's gonna turn on each other.
right yeah.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You spend a third of your life in your sheets, which is very healthy. You spend it asleep. Are your sheets taking care of you the way they should be? Introducing brooklinen.com, high-quality sheets and bedding at a price that won't keep you up at night. Founded in April 2014, Brooklinen offers simple, beautiful home essentials without the luxury price. It's the fastest-growing bedding brand in the world because people love these products. Their sheets have over 12,000 5-star reviews. Oh my gosh. Plus, they have versatile colors and patterns that complement any decor. This is luxury bedding, underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. I love my Brooklinen sheets. Try these sheets, and I know you'll love them too. Brooklinen has an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code James at brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. There's no reason, of course, not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code James at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code James. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. And then this whole next bit I thought was really funny because you almost tell like a joke within the joke. So they thought it would be easy because Alabama lulled them into a false sense of security. Alabama, AL, holy crap, this is easy. We're going to finish before they stop serving breakfast in the hotel restaurant. And now you start going into a tangent of all about the hotel breakfast. So that's like a, you could have told that joke separately, like whoever wanted to be, you go into this whole thing about the omelet chef, like who grows up and wants to be an omelet chef. People want to be a chef. Yeah. Like you could have told that as a separate joke, but you kind of tell that it's just as a tangent to this.
Yeah, I just know that I need a tangent. I knew the first time I looked at this as a potential for a joke that I needed a tangent to take the people's attention away from the next state, which has the whole reason I came up with this was this joke is because I found that so many of the states started with the first two letters, and I thought, oh, that must have been so frustrating and overwhelming for the people who were charged with coming up with these. And then I thought when I first started writing it, I need something to take the people's attention away from Alabama. If I go right to Alaska and the people notice that it's got the same first two letters, there's not as big of an impact on the audience. So I knew that I needed something to take their attention away from it. And somehow, some way, one night, it became the boss offering to take them out to breakfast. And the idea, I mean, it's just an inspiration.
Well, you know, because a lot of times people think you got to keep it all tight, like get like you were saying, go from laugh to laugh.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like we'll see at the end of this tangent, which goes on for a while, when they finally get to Alaska, there's been so much time passed that they can't even remember, and that becomes part of the whole joke.
Yeah.
But something you just said, like you thought it was funny how it must have been difficult because there's so many that states start with the same two letters. Who thinks about that? Like, why would you even think it? Like, in my entire life, I've been abbreviating the states. I've never thought, oh, so many states have the same first two letters. Like, what were you doing when you thought of that?
I think from the first time when I was in second grade and I got the arrow book of the states, and the arrow book of the states, one of the sections in the arrow book of the states was it had I got it in second grade, but it had to have been printed several years prior because the idea of the two capital letter abbreviations was a new concept in this particular version of the Arrow Book of States that I got from the RIF van, the Reading is Fundamental van that came to my school, and I remember for whatever reason I wanted to memorize the abbreviations, and I noticed how difficult it was because Alaska, Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, they had the same first letter, so it was a little bit difficult to memorize them. You really had to put some effort into it.
So you pulled that out and said, and you know, 40 years later,
said
this could be a joke.
Yeah,
like you turned that kind of difficulty you had in second grade into a joke.
Yeah,
and you know, I think that's I see a lot of, I think it's very easy being a comedian to just go straight to, let's just call them like fart jokes or crude jokes or whatever.
Right, yeah.
And then it's hard to figure out if you're being unique or like everyone else has done it. But clearly like this joke's going to be We're in new territory now in the joke world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I went, once I got a hold of it, I held on and really pounded away at it and tried to strengthen it and lengthen it. Yeah.
So now they go into this whole tangent of, you know, you say this funny thing, which is you don't just say they're going to go try out the omelet station. The omelet station had just been invented, which is absurdist,
right?
And was sweeping the nation. Yeah. Cliche again.
Yeah. So, right. Yeah.
And it also again has this 1970s feel, like, you know, the slinky is sweeping the nation.
Yeah.
You know, it's like has this like 1970s commercial feel to it.
Yeah.
And then you go into this kind of hidden truth, which we realize that, oh yeah, everybody who's wearing that chef's hat at the omelet station, they are not doing their live stream.
Right.
Like no chef went to chef school just to be the omelet chef at a buffet.
Yeah.
And it's almost sad for them.
Yeah.
And you're almost harsh here where you say like, no, none of them, first off, you say they want to be a chef, which is kind of funny, the alliteration.
Right. Yeah.
And then you say they want to be giving the orders. They don't want to be taking the orders from, you know, your stupid wife and your ugly kids. So you're almost a little hard there.
Right.
But it's true. Yeah. That's probably what they're thinking.
Yeah.
I never want to go to an omelet station again now.
Yeah. I've always felt uncomfortable with the omelet station because I feel like the omelet chef is. And then they can be actually the friendliest member of the buffet team in many cases, and they're very outgoing and
right, that's part of the job description almost.
Yeah. And I just feel like, oh my gosh, they must hate us. They just must really, really hate us. So this is another area of the joke that doesn't always get a good response. But it's a can't lose because at the very least I divert the people's attention from the main plot of the
right.
Story.
So the main plot, you're basically kind of buying yourself time because the more time you buy here, that's funny.
Yeah.
The main plot becomes funnier. Yeah. But at the same time, it's also a can't lose in that it is a real hidden truth that's funny. Like at least you're making an observation that's interesting and they probably haven't thought
of. But I've worked really hard over the years to try and make the omelet portion of it funnier and come up with different angles on it and different lines and all that. And it's just always, it's hit or miss.
I think people underestimate, like you're saying this story, again, the way you're saying this story is it's like you're actually describing a real documentary, you know, minute by minute and you're doing it very seriously. I think people underestimate it. Like you say, it took years to figure out the exact wording to make the omelet station. Like what was another way you presented this that wasn't as funny?
I don't think there ever was another it was always about breakfast and I think it always had the component of the omelet station and to make it longer I added my own opinion of the omelet station and how I feel about the omelet station and I figured that would ring true for everyone and it just doesn't.
Which could have just been a separate joke all by itself.
Yeah.
Like, did you ever go to the omelet station and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But like, you pour everything into this story filled with jokes. I think this is like an underestimated technique that could be used in anything from public speaking to comedy to whatever. These tangents are not what make the joke funny necessarily, but they add so much. And you do this a lot in a lot of your bits that I think other comedians are afraid to do because of the risk.
Yeah, it can be a little bit risky, but the payoff is really nice in this.
And the one other thing I want to mention about the omelet chef is it reminds me of a Louis C.K. thing on Conan also, where he points to all the musicians in the band and he says, none of these musicians are doing what they want to do.
Oh, God.
Like, this is just like from a few weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
He says they all want to be rock stars.
Yeah.
And now they're just playing for your shitty band.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And they were all laughing. And he's like, I'm not insulting them. They're doing great. Like, this is a great job for them. But they didn't like plan to do this. They studied like the oboe for like 15 years. They didn't plan to do this. So
that is really ballsy. I would never have the guts to say something so acerbic.
You think because they're right there?
Yeah, they're right there.
He backs off a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, because he says, "I they're doing great jobs."
Yeah.
You know, and he does that a couple of times in different scenarios, yeah. But.
Yeah, man, I'm in awe of him.
Okay, so let me see where I am here. The omelet station, he didn't want to be the omelet chef. He wanted to be the chef. Then you're kind of bringing us back now into the room with the abbreviators. The guy who wants to go to the omelet chef is like, he says, "I don't like holiday sauce." And somebody says to him, "Did you just say holiday sauce?"
Yeah.
So then you make this whole fun of like holiday versus hollandaise sauce.
Right.
Which again, like you're extending the tangent a little bit, but you're bringing us back into the room.
Yeah.
And so was that like an extra thing? Like, how can I extend this further? Or what were you, like, how did you come up with hollandaise?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that irritates me is when people say holiday sauce. It's like, are you really? You don't know that it's hollandaise sauce? I've known it's hollandaise sauce since the beginning. But I wouldn't want to have a joke that's just and it's possible you could have a joke. Ever you could start it off by saying the idea would be you'd say, "Oh, I have a friend," or ever have a friend that says holiday sauce? They say holiday sauce. Doesn't that drive you crazy when they say holiday sauce? And it's just, it's not really that strong enough to stand on its own, but to put it in this bigger package, it's much more manageable for me, and I can feel better about that.
Yeah, because there's other aspects of it that become funny because it's in a documentary. So was it really? So we're all believing that this was an actual documentary, and did they really argue about in a documentary a film that they could have edited it in any way?
Sure.
Did they really keep the argument between holiday and hollandaise sauce?
Yeah.
I guess if you were doing it standalone, you could say, "Did you ever have a friend who keeps saying holiday sauce and you don't want to embarrass him? Like it's at a dinner with your parents and you don't want to embarrass him or something."
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right, yeah.
But here you have it like perfectly in this story, and it works because then it extends getting back into the room. So the boss finally says, "Could we get back to abbreviating the states?" So now we're here. It took you like a minute segue to get back to here. We still have 49 states. They got back to abbreviating and they said, "What's next? Alaska." Everybody cool with AL? And now it took so long because of the omelet chef and the holiday sauce.
Yeah.
You know, it's understandable that your persona or that they in the room don't remember that they just said AL for Alabama. It's not 100% believable, but it's in a documentary, so it must be believable.
Yeah.
And even your main character describing it is not yet allowing the audience is already starting to laugh because they know what's happening, but your persona on the stage is not quite giving it to them yet.
Right. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that until just now, but the idea that the abbreviators in the abbreviating room didn't remember that they had just used AL is really silly.
Yeah.
They had to have.
They had to, but you, but it's part of the joke because then they say, "Dottie, can you read the minutes?"
Yeah.
And then you get into this whole thing about Dottie being this like almost 1940s secretary.
Right.
You know, where she's
sort of
like
a Mad Men era secretary.
Like let's say, early 1960s secretary, where she's like just this raunchy, everything is like this one liner. And there's no other way to do that other than in this story. But before you do that, before you get to Dottie, you say someone caught it. Like only one person out of all the abbreviators caught it.
Yeah.
And he like you're acting it out. You're like sheepishly raising your arm. One man raised his hand and said, "I think we might have used that one before." And they're all like, "Are you sure?" Because they don't have like the documentary almost becomes absurd because they don't have the capacity to remember Alabama still at this point.
Right.
So they have to go back to the minutes.
Yeah.
But now we're all in it. Even though we know it's not true, we're all in the story.
Yeah.
So here's where I think is the most risky because at this point, clearly, nothing is real. But we're in this, we believe you. We're in the story.
Yeah.
And we want to hear it. So we check the minutes. There's Dottie. Oh, and here you did something different again also. You put yourself in the documentary. So the persona who's describing the documentary in this Dottie story, she's about to give a line, and you say, "How Dottie is this?"
Right.
And as if you somehow know Dottie, and as if the audience all knows Dottie, but we haven't seen her yet.
Yeah.
It's like we're all now in the documentary with the abbreviators,
right,
which is a new switch in the joke.
Yeah.
So I don't know how planned that was. Like, you're bringing us even closer in.
Well, I had a lunch one day, and this woman was sitting with her friend, and she was telling a story of how she had told somebody off, and she said, "How Melissa was that?" About herself. She was speaking of herself, and that's
her name was Melissa.
Yeah, she was Melissa. She said, "How Melissa is that?" And her friend said, "So Melissa." And that moment on, I was like, I have to work that into a joke somehow. The idea of somebody talking like that is so obnoxious and so funny to me. And again, that piece of the bit is hit or miss, but I always try to do it because it's so entertaining to me.
I can't see how it would miss, because it's so absurd.
Yeah.
Like, that now we're supposed to know how Dottie is.
Right.
And like, we haven't met her at all.
Yeah.
And, but it's also interesting. So you made one observation about an obnoxious conversation. Did you write it down, or like, how did you remember that?
Yeah, it was written down, but also it was so compelling that I remembered it even without writing it down. It just, and I retold it to people, and I actually tried to tell it as a standalone joke, and I remember it did okay. But
what was the standalone joke?
I tried to tell the story of how obnoxious this woman was, and it did okay. But so much of a joke staying in an act has to do with how it goes over the first one or two times you tell it. Like, if certain portions of this joke didn't go over early on in its history, then they wouldn't have made it, and I wouldn't. The only thing I will say is sometimes I have a stubbornness about what I think is funny, and I'm proud of that, because I think it's necessary to be an original comedian, is to have a stubbornness about what you think is funny. I don't think I'm as stubborn as some people are. Like, I think of somebody like when I watch this old series called Get a Life with Chris Elliott, I'm like, that guy was really, really convinced of what he knew was funny and put it out there, and just made it something that I think is such an unrivaled masterpiece. But I think Letterman strikes me as that way too, that he really was stubborn about what he thought was funny and would not break on that. So I think to bring it back to the joke, it's just that I can only handle a couple of instances of a joke bombing before I say I don't feel comfortable telling that.
But if it makes you laugh, you try a little harder to keep it in.
Try very hard to keep it in. Yeah.
You know, speaking of Letterman, and like, let's take his performance at the Oscars. I thought the Uma Oprah was hilarious.
Hilarious.
Actually. And why didn't people like that one? Was great.
I have no idea. I thought that was brilliant and original and funny and turned the Oscars into like a common luncheon.
Yeah,
that you had in your house that you would introduce two people that I thought it was hilarious. Yeah,
I guess like absurdism doesn't work as well in a setting like that as much as roasting. Like, roasting seems like okay in an Oscars monologue, but absurdism doesn't go over as well, because they don't get it. Like, Oprah doesn't get it.
Yeah, it goes over certain people's heads. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
All right, so then let's see what I got here. All right, so I point out again that you're subtracting your knowledge, the persona's knowledge, that we don't know who Dottie is at all.
Right.
So it seems like, again, comedy is a lot about subtraction, because you're super smart. You're telling this story about a smart documentary, ostensibly, and you keep subtracting more and more. Like, obviously, we don't know in the audience who Dottie is. So again, do you think... I think almost all comedians do some sort of subtraction to create a persona.
Yeah.
Let's take Amy Schumer as an example. She's not like this... As far as I know, she's not this like slutty woman, but that's the persona she plays. She subtracts sort of this non-slutty part of herself.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe she exaggerates her history.
Right.
Yeah.
So, So you go on. They quickly go through Arizona, Arkansas. You know, and then he says, "Shit, we'll come back to it," because they're starting to realize. Before that. They said Alaska, AOL. And so the boss says, it's not going to happen again. Certainly not going to happen 27 more times, which is the exact number of times it happened. So that's
just
funny.
But then
you extend that by saying foreshadowing. Yeah. So clearly it was foreshadowing, but you underline it.
Yeah.
The specificity plus the extending it seems funny to me.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this bit is deconstructing the actual structure of a documentary or of a narrative. So the idea of friends becoming enemies becoming friends, that's sort of something that happens in a lot of narratives and a lot of stories. And,
right, like it's an archetype of a story.
Yeah, right, and so also you're going to have some foreshadowing in a movie. So
right, and there's also going to be more problems than are expected, and you specifically say the number of problems, 27. Like the specificity is funny.
Yeah,
and also I noticed after foreshadowing, you gave a really big pause. You were silent for a while, I guess because there was laughing, and then you just paused through it. Because I guess maybe now then you're switching to the next. They just start going down the list of states. Arizona, AR, Arkansas, shit, we'll come back to it. What's next? California, CA, Colorado, CO, Connecticut, which is, of course, going to be CO. But you don't even say the CO there.
Yeah.
You make a face and look down as if you're the boss in the documentary.
Right.
And, you know, we are screwed. So you're playing now the boss in the documentary. You're not just telling the story. You know, and then there's more Dottie, somebody needs a drink. Not now, Dottie. And then now you're back out of it, and you say by the time they got to Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, followed by Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, and Missouri, shots were fired. So that's funny because the alliteration and just so many problems.
Right.
And it's still this obviously simple task, but you've made this simple task like so incredibly complicated. Like, what are they going to do? It's hopeless.
Yeah.
So it's now gone from being, now we in this fake way, you realize why it becomes a 98 minute documentary.
Yeah.
And people are laughing. But, you know, you say shots were fired, they're at each other's throats. So they hired a consultant, they brought in a contractor, a contractor.
Right.
And someone who contracts words.
Yeah.
And so that was funny.
Yeah, that was actually one night a mistake that I made. I meant to say always they hired a contractor. I always meant to say contractor, but one night I said a contractor. And when I said, oh, I'm sorry, a contractor, it got a laugh, so I kept that in.
Yeah, so I thought that was funny. The use of the word, it again reminds me of a Louis C.K. joke from later where he describes someone who has, I think he's describing someone who has sex with a minor. And then he says, not a minor, a miner, like a coal miner.
Oh, okay.
So, but it reminded me of that, of that, joke, which came later.
Yeah.
But also I thought it was funny. First off, they were clapping with the contractor in the Conan bits. They weren't just laughing, they were clapping.
Right.
And it also reminded me of movies like, again, mafia type movies where everything it gets so messed up in the middle of a movie, they have to call in the cleaner or whatever, someone to come in and like solve all the problems.
Yeah.
And so that's totally what you're mimicking there with something as simple as abbreviating states.
Right.
And then you use as an example of what a professional contractor is, O'Clock, which is funny because he, instead of saying of the clock, he got rid of the sound. which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
What made you come up with, well, a clock, I guess, has the K.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's also, I was just looking for the most common abbreviations, and that's probably the most common abbreviation there is, O'clock, because we use it as many as 24 times a day. So,
by the way, that was funny.
Thank you.
Because we don't really use it 24
right,
times
right,
a day.
Right, yeah. So, I thought that would be the lead off. That would be the funniest one is always either going to be the first or the last part of a when you're doing a list, should always be the first or the last. So I wanted it to be first, because my theory is that especially if it's at the end of a set, and usually I close with this, that you're going to get a big applause for saying thank you and good night. So I'd rather start off with the strongest one first. So let's see. Many years ago, people would say it's 9 of the clock. Yeah. So I had that knowledge of knowing that's what o'clock was abbreviating. And
then just you making the sound like was funny.
Right.
Cause I don't really think of like what actually is being, nobody ever thinks of what actually was contracted there.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think o'clock is funnier than other common ones. Like would have is clearly would have.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't even know until then what o'clock was.
Oh, really?
Contracted. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Did you know? Like, did you have to look it up?
No, or I've known it since I was a little kid.
That's funny. Yeah. So, but then the next one was, you say this visionary said, we don't need the, he said, I can do that with a sky comma.
Yeah.
So again, I had never even heard the phrase sky comma before.
Oh, I coined that phrase.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah.
And everybody laughed and clapped at that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I want to point out that I take pride in is that he wrote such timeless classics as a clock. To call it timeless is ironic.
Yeah, I did not.
Because it's time full.
I did not notice that.
Right, yeah.
So again, it seems like you took a couple of relatively simple observations, like, oh, there are a lot of states with two letters. Omelet chefs don't want to be omelet chefs. There's all these cliches. And then you kind of, you figure out how to make those funny in odd settings. Like, okay, let's put that in a documentary. Let's put the omelet chef as a tangent here. And then you're using all these kind of, I don't want to call them standard rules of comedy, but you call them rules. So like make it the first and the last of a list, the funniest. So there's kind of a method to the madness a little bit.
Yeah.
You have to start with the observations that are unique. But I think, again, most people try, or I feel like when I'm trying to do this, even like when I'm giving a public talk, I'm trying to initially think of something funny. You're taking something in many cases boring or everyday and trying to work really hard. Like you say, it took years to make it funny.
Yeah.
And that's particularly hard.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But that's...
That's where the payoff is, I guess.
That's where the payoff is. And there's never been... There have never been more comedians. So it's so hard to have something original and then to have your original piece stand out is even harder. So it's just it requires this kind of legwork.
Yeah, like anybody can make jokes, and I'm not saying this is good or bad. Like anyone can make jokes about their dating life, but whatever you say about your dating life, there's a good chance it's been said before. It might not be said in the exact way you say it, and it might not be even the words you exactly use, but probably some aspect of it has been said, or parents about their kids, or people about the food they eat, or whatever you say about your ethnic background.
Right.
Although you had a funny joke in the last set that I saw you in, because you're 6'6" and Jewish, and you combine that with, like, you would think if God's given me this, and this is from a year ago, so I'm trying to remember, if God's given me this, why didn't he get, you know, you would think he would also get rid of the neuroses and all that, and, you know,
I remember that,
that was funny, and that's where you're saying something about your ethnic background, but it's unique because also you're 6'6" and Jewish, which is unusual. But again, is this trying to find the unique and the unusual and making it funny. So then you have, after the sky comma, he also wrote, would have, could have, should have, the holy trinity of regret, which is funny.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought of it that way.
Right. Yeah.
Those are the things you regret. Like, oh, I could have done this. I should have done this. I would have done that if I'd known.
Yeah.
You only use those when you're regretting something.
Right.
So there's like a hidden truth there. And then he wrote, won't. People said, how will you write will not and not use a single L? He said, watch me. Are you saying I won't do it? I just did.
Yeah.
And that's basically how you close the act.
I feel, you know, I've always felt that the bit tails off at the end there, and it's because the o'clock part is the funniest part. And I've tried telling the o'clock part last, and it just doesn't stand up that way. So I feel like it tails off at the end, and I wish I could. And I've tried to come up with funnier closing lines.
But there's kind of the are you saying I won't do it? I just did. There's this like in your face, like you, it's almost like it allows you to like, you know, lean into the microphone and point. I just did, and that does seem like a good way to close. Like, I don't know how you do that with the o'clock.
Right. Yeah. It was hard to close with the o'clock. It's easier to close with the won't part. But again, the won't thing was something that I had tried probably a long time ago as a separate joke. The idea that will not, did not, should not abbreviate to won't, that it was a cheat somehow, and that it didn't really make sense.
So a lot of this kind of evolved out of maybe like older jokes that you were able to make somehow this filter or this overlay of this absurdist documentary made some of these jokes funnier than they initially were.
Yeah.
But you're able to kind of like go back and look at your older material and sort of say, okay, here's a home for them.
Right.
So that's part of the years of development of this. Because clearly what you have here is maybe 10 to 15 one-liners that could work by themselves as well. But putting it in this story is this extra risk. And you know, it's just like they say in the stock market, you know, the greater the risk you take, the more potential for high returns. And that's what's happening in comedy as well here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's greater than the sum of its parts. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't know of any, I can't think of any comedian who will tell a 6.5-minute story about abbreviating states and still have like each line be funny. Like that's, again, a huge risk because you could just falter off in the middle.
Yeah.
And you're in it. You're stuck.
Yeah, I'm sure there are comedians in England in particular, perhaps that do something, you know, not the exact subject or topic, but a similar style or delivery.
Really, why in England is that like a different?
I think absurdism goes over better in England with those audiences. I think those audiences are a little more sophisticated than the two drink minimum people over here.
That's interesting because I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like obviously observational humor has been big for, let's say, the past 15 years even. And then observational humor combined with, oh, let's talk these real truths. Like, this is how I really feel about my children, or this is how I really feel about, you know, dating. That's also, that combined with observational humor has become even bigger. But I feel like absurdism is kind of coming back somehow. Like you have, you know, whether it's Louis C.K. or Bo Burnham or Amy Schumer, like there's just lots of absurdist stuff happening combined with observational humor.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really great. I love absurdism. Yeah.
Cause like your foreplay joke, why would anybody do sexual foreplay where someone's the Secretary of Housing and Development and the other one's the Assistant Secretary of Housing, like even just Housing and Urban Development, like why that cabinet department?
Yeah, it's the funniest named cabinet department to me.
To you?
And also it's very, it would be controversial too.
Right, I guess so. And I guess it's funny because it's long.
Yeah,
like it's Secretary as opposed to like Secretary of State. It's just
right,
like
Secretary of State is not funny, but Secretary of Housing and Urban Development would be funny. I mean, to me, Secretary of the Interior would be funny because it's an obscure cabinet post. But Housing and Urban Development is the funniest to me.
I guess it's funny too because you don't really know what the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development does every day.
Right.
Like when you say later in that joke, you're not pushing your agenda enough, or you know, in the next line of that joke, what could possibly her agenda be?
Yeah.
So it's funny. So again, but that's absurdist too. So, but also there's an observational component to it. Like, okay, there's the foreplay aspect and the idea that it's more and more difficult to get out of the cliches in, you know, role playing, you know, it's not right. Waitress, client. Yeah. And then just this idea that you're you work for her in this like cabinet position is a cabinet position that may or may not do anything. That's kind of observational.
Right.
So it seems like there's all these kind of intersections of all these different styles, like observational, hidden truth, absurdism, and then you're taking these standard rules, like, oh, let's use the K sound, you know, make the first and the last the funniest. All that kind of together is the craft. And you could see why. Like, how long have you been doing stand-up comedy?
23 years.
23 years.
Yeah.
So literally nobody can catch up. Like,
wow.
It's impossible. Like, someone starting now, they're going to have to do it for 23 years.
Yeah, but I think people have a better learning curve than I have. I watch some of the young comedians like John Mulaney or Michael Che or Colin Jost or Chris Gethard and the guys like this and that. They just seem to really Mike Birbiglia. They seem to really really hit their stride very very quickly and become very very accomplished. Very quickly.
That could be, and this takes away nothing from them. Like, all those people are great, but this joke is hard to do.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to come up with.
Right.
As you were saying before, you're feeling anxious about what to do for your next hour and special. And so it seems like, you know, when I've seen you in let's say the Comedy Cellar, you're now or you were then coming up with the next batch of, let's say, smaller jokes that could potentially combine into like a larger story. So I don't know, like, how do you get down to work on like the next 6.5 minute bit?
Yeah. It's daunting.
And how do you deal with the anxiety?
another thing. I've been struck, really, it's the bane of my existence, the anxiety. It just overwhelms me and it cripples me.
Like, but when you wake up, do you think, oh my God, I have to do this, but I'm not going to be able to? Is that like the first thoughts in your head?
Yeah. I mean, I'm reluctant. I feel very comfortable talking to you, and so I'll say this, but it's something that I don't know how. Hopefully, this will be helpful to people, but it's something that's very personal to me, and I don't like to reveal to too many people. But I wound up in the hospital at Cornell Weill for a few nights because of my depression and anxiety. I just was overwhelmed. A couple of months ago, I think it was in April, that I wound up in the hospital over it. And just I wasn't suicidal. I just went to the emergency room and they admitted me, and I was there for a few days, and they changed some medicines up and things like that. But it's literally crippling. Yeah.
Did that help? Like, did they? I mean, a combination of medication and them talking. Did that help at all?
Yeah. I'm in a better position now than I was then, and I can function and a little bit better, and I've been able to get back on stage. I don't think I went on stage for the last two weeks of April and the first couple of weeks of May. I just did not feel comfortable getting on stage. I thought I might panic or lose my place.
Did you had you experienced panicking on stage right before then, or losing your place?
No, but there was an immense dread about performing and about it going on in front of people, and the self-criticism was so high that I didn't feel that I was qualified. I didn't feel qualified to perform.
Which is amazing considering all you've done in comedy. And I know saying that means nothing is like meaningless to what's going on in your head.
Yeah.
But clearly many people shouldn't be on the stage when people go on the stage, including myself, by the way.
Stop.
So have you gone on since?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been on, you know, probably 20 times since I got out of the hospital. I do fine. I've done probably 90% of jokes that I'd done before. Not much new material.
And new being new since the last special, or you're doing jokes from even older specials or whatever?
No, I would say I did mostly jokes from the last special, and then new stuff. I mean, stuff that's less than a few months old.
So there's two types of ways, right? Or several types of ways to deal with anxiety. But one thing, obviously, which you tried is going to a talk therapy, medication, all those things in the hospital. But then also, are there peers you could sort of work with and kind of, you know, almost like a, you know, sort of just for a short period of time, not necessarily an accountability partner, but like a coach of some sort that you trust, who's in your area, who can help work through maybe this particular, or recognize where the particular bottlenecks might be?
Yeah, I have worked with a few friends on my jokes and also just talking out this frustration with them has been helpful, because this is not something that is unique to me. Every comedian I talk to, they talk about their struggle to come up with new material and just how frustrating it is and how long it takes and how much work it takes and that's probably the bottom line is that I'm going to have to take more risks on stage, and that's one of the reasons I'm moving back to Boston is that I feel I'll be more comfortable taking the risks on stage in Boston rather than at the Comedy Cellar in New York City.
What does it mean to take more risks?
Just to go on stage with material that is not as worked out as the joke we went over today. To go on there with the components of something like that and work it out and then record it and listen to it or just try to remember it and write it down and then try it out and adjust it and tweak it and. That's what I have to do.
I mean, a little bit. That's what, like, as an example, that's like what Chris Rock does when he's starting a new hour.
Yeah,
he'll go to I guess whatever it's called, the Laugh Factory in New Brunswick or the Stress Factory in New Brunswick, and just literally read off of a pad, and see what gets laughs.
Right.
That.
Yeah.
So it's, you're doing the equivalent of that.
Yeah, but I'm not at the at a level and I don't feel comfortable reading off a pad. I would. To do more, try to memorize more of the jokes and go up there maybe with just a list of the topics and have in my head already the components of the joke.
Do you think it gets, like, as you said, you're not the first comedian to have this problem of coming up with new material, and in part because it's not like you're at a regular job where even if you screw up for a couple of weeks, you're still getting the paycheck at those 2 weeks. Like, someone could be very volatile in their performance at a job, but their paycheck is steady until the day they're fired. So it becomes more a matter of avoiding being fired rather than doing a good job. Whereas a comedian has to do a good job. That's how your career is created.
Yeah.
So do you think, though, at a certain point, like, you've been doing it for so long and have all these specials that actually makes it harder to come up with new material than say a beginning comedian who is at the beginning of that steep curve, can take those risks, hasn't set the bar high for themselves yet.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you and Louis C.K. and Jim Gaffigan do for your next specials? I can't even imagine what you have to do.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen the special yet, but I know that Kevin Hart's last special was called What's Next, and I imagine that was a big question for him to answer after he had done shows in such huge venues, but I feel the same way. It's like what do I do to for the next special, and how do I make it as good as or better than you're reluctant to go out there with less strong material than the last special, so the expectations of the audience are higher. The one of the positive things is that at this point I have fans who are there to see me, so I think they have a similar sense of humor to me, so I can be a little bit more absurdist and a little more quirky with those audiences, so that they'll give me more license to be what I think is funny. And so that's helpful.
And you'll have that, because they're a friendly audience, you'll have that rapport built really easily.
Yeah.
So it's easier to try stuff out. They're going to laugh, you know, at your gestures, because they'll recognize them and it'll be funny for them.
Yeah.
So when you're moving to Boston soon, you're going to work on the new material. Hopefully we'll see new material from you sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
You ever think about making a book of all your prior material, kind of like a sign language type of thing?
Yeah. I've,
like, just even analyzing this is such a pleasure for me. Like,
oh,
this is like
you.
A gift to me to sit down with you and go over line by line this joke, and hopefully for the listeners as well. But it's an amazing thing.
I hope the listeners enjoy it. If I were to find out that the listeners enjoy it, I could see doing that with other jokes, either with you or on paper, because it is alchemy in a way. I mean, that's overstating it, but
no, it's not overstating it, because how do you take language again with public speaking? There's a gimmick, which is, oh, you're talking about X and you're telling stories. The stories might be funny, but there's not the craft of the punchline and the funny sounds and the pauses and the delivery and the alliteration and the many, many, and the tangents and the many, many other things that go into this craft. I think it's incredibly helpful to learn and listen and hear.
I'm glad. Yeah, so, that makes me happy, because I do enjoy talking about it, because it was a pleasurable process to construct. I a joke like this, you're really more constructing than writing, because you're putting it, building it.
Yeah. Well, Gary Goldman, once again, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Podcast,
it was my pleasure.
I really love
being on with you. Thank you.
It's I've listened to this joke probably 30 or 40 times.
Wow.
I've had questions about it. And like I said, whenever I do public speaking, I'm so nervous beforehand that listening to you, and again, I have a few go-tos, always makes me like it's like an injection that makes me like a better public speaker for about 45 minutes.
Wow, that makes me very happy.
Go on right away.
I'm very happy to hear that. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, James.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Thanks for listening. Did you know I come out with new episodes every Tuesday? And actually now I'm thinking of coming out with more episodes per week. If you subscribe, you'll never miss an episode, and I have a lot of great interviews coming up. Again, thank you so much. I really hope you do this.